welcome to the March edition of the Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
Spring is here and my wardrobe is beginning to change. How are you doing this spring, Anna?
I'm great. I've noticed your wardrobe changing. You're wearing a lot of Lycra.
Well, it is Bumps Weekend and I'm very excited about that. But we're here to talk about astronomy. So what's going on in the world of astronomy?
Yeah, so Quinton, I've heard something about this CO satellite. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that's right, Anna. Looks like NASA have made another glaring mistake. Apparently their CO2 satellite, which was supposed to be measuring the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, didn't quite make it into space. Apparently the section carrying the satellite failed to split open in the upper atmosphere, taking the satellite back down to Earth with it. A big mistake, so no CO2 data for us.
That's horrible. I heard that it was something over $200 million that were lost by NASA in this whole failed project.
Well, these are expensive satellites, and they never make backups, so they're back to square one with that project.
Oh, that's really unfortunate. Well, the good news, you can perk up your spirits if you're upset about the crashed NASA satellite or failed science in general by coming to experience the Cambridge Science Festival with lots of excellent, wonderful science and hands-on things for the family to do.
That's right, Anna. The Cambridge Science Festival really is a fantastic opportunity for everyone to get hands-on science experience. There's events being run by almost every department across the university, and it's running from the 9th of March to the 22nd. If you want more information, then you can get it at www.cambridgescience.org.
The Institute of Astronomy will be hosting our open day on Saturday, March 21st, from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m., with observing after 7 p.m. if it's clear.
There's loads going on our open day, and I thoroughly encourage everyone to come and get involved. We've got loads of talks going on. You can experience what real moon dust is. You can look at the telescopes, which are going to be open throughout the afternoon. And there's the Planet Factory, where kids can learn a bit about planets and even paint their own. Now, if you'd like to book for the observing evenings on the 11th or the 18th of March, you've got to do that in advance, because it's Science Week and they always fill up fast. So to do that, you need to call the number 01223-766-766.
Well, not so fast, Quincy. Don't forget that the Astropod will be there recording live, so please bring your questions, because we'd love to have you on the air.
I'm sorry, Anna, I almost completely forgot. That's right, for the first time ever, the Astropod will be at the open day. So do come along and chat to us. We'd love to hear what you guys think.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you.
And now, it's over to Laura with the Astro News.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Satellites collide. February saw the first major collision between two satellites in Earth orbit. The two satellites involved were a defunct Russian communications satellite named Cosmos 2251, which smashed right into an operational US communications satellite named Iridium 33 over Siberia. This collision not only completely destroyed the satellites with an energy comparable to the explosion of 5 tons of TNT, but has created a spreading cloud of debris which poses a hazard to other satellites. Cosmos and Iridium were in a low Earth orbit, at a height of 750 kilometers above the Earth's surface, a height shared by many satellites, but significantly higher than the 350 kilometer high orbit of the International Space Station. Currently, the US Space Surveillance Network is tracking more than 500 large chunks of debris, but it will take more time to estimate the full extent of the collision debris, as many smaller particles will also have been produced. NASA's chief scientist for orbital debris estimated that the satellite collision created approximately 1,000 pieces of junk, larger than 10 centimetres, in addition to many smaller ones. NASA says the risk to the International Space Station is low, as is any threat to a shuttle launch planned for later this month. However, Chinese scientists have said that the debris does pose a threat to Chinese satellites in sun-synchronous orbits. Some of the debris has been falling into the Earth's atmosphere, prompting warning to pilots, and there have even been some reports of sonic booms associated with falling bits of satellite. There is also some concern that the fallout from the collision could cause a delay to a mission to perform crucial repairs to the Hubble Space Telescope, scheduled to launch in May. Without the repairs, Hubble only has a couple of working years left, but as its orbit is higher than that of the International Space Station, it is closer to the cloud of debris. The wreckage from the satellites poses a particular threat to astronauts on a spacewalk, which will be necessary to fix the ailing telescope. NASA officials are set to decide in mid-March whether the mission is too risky. Smallest exoplanet yet found. The record for the smallest planet orbiting a sun-like star has once again been broken. Corot Exo 7b has only twice the diameter of the Earth at 25,000 kilometres. It was discovered by Corro, a European satellite which monitors stars, looking for tiny dips in their brightness that could indicate a planet passing in front of the star. Corro XO7b has an orbit of around 20 hours, indicating it is very close to its parent star. Compare this to our own solar system, where Mercury, the planet with the shortest orbit, takes 88 days to orbit the Sun. The planet's surface will be very hot, up to 1,500 degrees centigrade. Although we know the radius of Corro XO7b, we won't know what it's made of until we can determine its mass. Given its small size, it's not likely to be composed of gas like Jupiter, but is more likely to primarily contain rock or metal like the Earth. Corro XO7b marks the first potential discovery of a terrestrial or rocky planet like the Earth. Fermi spots biggest gamma ray burst. Fermi, the gamma ray telescope formerly known as GLAST, has spotted the most energetic gamma ray burst ever seen. A gamma ray burst is a huge, high-energy explosion, thought to originate in the violent destruction of a massive star. Such explosions produce very high-energy photons, each with an energy up to 5 billion times that of a visible light photon. A team led by Jochen Greiner at the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics in Garching, Germany, established that the blast occurred at a distance of 12.2 billion light-years away. The huge distance from Earth implies that the original energy of the blast was greater than 9,000 supernovae. Already this was an exciting burst, said Julie McHenry, a Fermi deputy project scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. But with the distance, it went from exciting to extraordinary.
Thanks for that, Laura. Since this week's interview deals with general relativity, this week's feature is on the history of relativity. Albert Einstein is one of the most famous scientists of modern times, and he is the author of Special and General Relativity. Let's start by deconstructing the names of these theories. You'll notice that the word relativity comes up in both. This refers to the basic idea that states of motion and rest are subjective and determined by who is doing the observing. For example, if you're traveling in a car with a cup of coffee, you'll say that the coffee isn't moving. However, a person standing on the side of the road will say that your coffee is moving as fast as the car. Now for the next part of the name. Special relativity only deals with objects that are in constant, uniform motion, while general relativity deals with all objects, including those that are accelerating. General relativity is often described as Einstein's theory of gravity because it is within this theory that Einstein mathematically explained how space and time warp in the presence of massive bodies, resulting in gravitational attraction between those two masses. Einstein published his theory of special relativity in a 1905 paper entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. The bulk of the work to compile this theory was completed in only 5 to 6 weeks. Einstein's motivation for creating special relativity was to solve a contemporary problem with the physics of moving magnets. The problem is that if you were moving with the magnet, you will measure a different field around the magnet than if you were sitting still and measuring the magnet's field as it flies past you. In explaining away this problem using special relativity, Einstein challenged the scientific paradigm that had persisted for thousands of years, that everyone can agree upon who is in motion and who is at rest. Now with special relativity, the new standard that everyone can always agree upon is the speed of light. Einstein wasn't satisfied with his theory of special relativity. He recognized in 1907 that special relativity could not adequately treat accelerating objects, and it would take him another 7 years to formulate general relativity. Along the way to finalizing his theory, Einstein created and used numerous now-famous thought experiments. For example, he realized that if a box was accelerated in one direction, its contents would behave as if they were in a gravitational field. You will have experienced this when you're in a lift, accelerating upwards and feel heavier, as if gravity is stronger for a short time. Therefore, he took a leap and postulated that being in a gravitational field is equivalent to undergoing uniform acceleration. Other thought experiments led him to the conclusion that light is bent by gravity and that gravity requires curved space-time. General relativity was famously confirmed by Sir Arthur Eddington when in 1919 he measured the deflection of starlight by the sun during a solar eclipse. While Einstein is most famous for the theories of special and general relativity, he received his 1921 Nobel Prize in Physics for work he did on a quantum mechanical phenomenon called the photoelectric effect. This work was completely unrelated to his work on relativity, which was considered too controversial to merit a Nobel Prize. So now that you've heard a little bit about relativity, here's Quincy, who's interviewing Chris Beckwith about relativistic jets in astronomy.
Hello and welcome to the interview section of the AstroPod. This month, I'm very pleased to introduce my guest, Chris Beckwith. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks.
Chris, you're a postdoctoral researcher here at the IOA, having done your PhD at the University of Durham on general relativity in 2005. Now, today you're going to be talking to us about relativistic jets in astronomy. So let's start at the beginning. What exactly is a jet in astronomy?
Well, a jet is an extremely rapid, fast outflow from some kind of object. We see them in young stellar objects. Those are the kind of stars that have just formed. We see them in active galactic nuclei. So that's basically coming from the cores of galaxies. We see them from black holes, which are about around a stellar mass to 10 stellar masses. We see them in neutron stars. So they're kind of ubiquitous in a lot of really exciting areas of astrophysics. And they basically are, like I said, very fast outflows where they have, there's two classes. There's relativistic jets where you have the motion of the jet is close to the speed of light. And then you have slower jets from things like young stellar objects where the outflow is faster than the escape velocity, obviously, but it's not relativistic.
It appears as if jets appear across a whole range of phenomena in astronomy. Is it just that we need some object and some material falling onto a massive object to create a jet, or is it more complicated than that?
It is more complicated, and it really depends on the type of jet that we're talking about. If we're talking about a relativistic jet where the outflow is moving at close to the speed of light, then that's actually quite difficult to do if you just have material falling onto the object. When you have just, say, gas being accreted, which is what we call the process of falling onto the object, if we try and launch an outflow just from the gas, then you can only really get things up to about the escape velocity from the object, from the part radius that the outflow is being launched from. But relativistic jets, we see them at close to the speed of light, and that's Lorentz factors, astronomer talk, of around 10. So that's just telling you that these things are moving very, very fast indeed.
That's very close to the speed of light.
Indeed. And to do that, you have to use something else just rather than just the gas. And the way to do that is magnetic fields. And that's how you get things up to these velocities. There's magnetic fields let you do all sorts of nice, exciting things with both disks and jets. And we actually know now that the accretion process itself, how you get the matter from, say, large radius, large separations away from the object you're trying to get it onto, how you get that matter down onto there actually intimately involves magnetic fields. Magnetic fields basically allow matter to be accreted because they move angular momentum around through your accretion disk. And it turns out that when you bring them down close to, say, a black hole, they can interact with the black hole in such a way as to build one of these relativistic jets. And that's what I try and study kind of in detail.
Now, it sounds like it's getting very complicated already because we've got gas physics going on, we've got magnetic fields, and to top this all off, the gas is moving so fast, we've got to take relativity into account. Now, you're involved in the modelling side of jets. Just how do you go about sort of trying to couple all of these various different sort of physical principles into one single model?
It's, like you say, it's very difficult. Magnetic fields are incredibly nonlinear, and the actual processes that are going on in the disk involve what we term in the literature magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, which sounds really complicated, but on some level what you can basically understand it as is you've got all sorts of kind of fluctuations going on in the disk, you've got tangled magnetic fields, and that produces this thing called turbulence, and that's really the underlying thing that's driving the accretion process. And that's horribly nonlinear. And the really only way to study that right now is via very large computer simulation. And what I mean by very large computer simulation, you have your standard kind of desktop PC. You have maybe two processors in it. What we use to do these simulations involves a machine that has thousands upon thousands of processors, and they all talk to each other. And we build basically a computer code that solves the equations of magnetohydrodynamics, which basically tells us how gas and magnetic fields evolve together. And we basically build that code, and we set it up one of these large computers and run it with some choices about our initial state of the disk and the magnetic field. And that's how we try and solve these things right now. That's really the only approach that we can use for this, because the physics of what's going on is so complex that you can't really gain any kind of insight by sitting there with a pen and paper beyond kind of very simple results.
So that's what you meant by non-linear. In fact, yeah. The physics is so complicated, I can't sit there with a pen and pad and try and work out what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you just have to time step through almost.
Exactly. That's it. We start out with some initial state, and we make some assumptions about that initial state. So we have a reservoir of gas. We have some configuration for the magnetic field. And then we basically take a set of equations that are well-known and relatively well-understood, and we say, given this initial state, how does that system evolve? And we try and basically understand for different initial states what happens to the system, and based on that, we try and say, what would this be in nature? What can we get from how nature works from this?
Now, this all sounds like it's going to take a lot of computer time. If I were to run this on my desktop PC, how long is it going to take me?
Well, you would be there for several years, let's put it that way. I mean, we typically use about 1,000 processors. But it's slightly more complex because you can't really get kind of the resolutions onto one processor. It actually requires these kind of many thousands of processors to do it, just because what we're using requires so much memory within the computer, and one processor can't actually access that amount of memory. So it really requires these large computers.
So you must be using some of the fastest computers in the country.
We're using the Darwin machine here at the University of Cambridge, which has got a couple of thousand processors, and I'm also using a machine in Texas, which has about 64,000 processors all linked together. So that's actually one of the most powerful computers in the world right now.
So how long does it take you to run one of your sort of typical simulations on the Darwin machine?
Takes around 10 days of constant running. So takes a long time.
Now, one of the exciting things about simulations is that we can then sort of try and look back and test our theories about the universe. Just how are you able to sort of test the theory of general relativity?
So that's actually something that is kind of right at the forefront of what we're trying to do now. When we take a model of how the disk works, we can calculate things like spectra, X-ray spectra in the case of black holes, from the disk model. And people have been doing this now for, must be nearly 30 years. But a lot of the models that they've been using to do that have just been simple, kind of one-dimensional analytic models that are just based on very simple physical arguments like conservation of energy, conservation of angular momentum. And what people do is they take those and they can make a few assumptions, and then they say this is the spectrum. What we do is we try and go back a step and say, if we take a simulation where we actually do all of this stuff self-consistently, we can then take, say, for example, the way that the disk heats. We can study that. We can get that information out directly from the simulation. And then we can put that into a model that just takes the conditions in the simulation for, say, the gas density. And we can figure out, say, an ionization state. And then we can calculate a spectrum from that. And then we can say to observers, well, here's what we think our nice simulation with all of this self-consistent physics says, and you can compare this to your data, or at least that's how we'd like to do it. that's kind of really on the bleeding edge of what we're trying to do right now. it's a step forward from what was done previously, because the analytic models, they're based on conservation of energy and conservation of angular momentum arguments, but they don't tell you how angular momentum is transported in the disk. And that's really important, because it's the angular momentum transport process that's really driving everything. And the analytic models, they just assume that there is something that does it. What we do in our simulations is we model that part of it self-consistently. We actually say the magnetic fields are transporting angular momentum. And given that, we get a disk structure. And from that, we can build up to a spectrum. And in the analytic models, that process is all founded on assumption that the about the angular momentum transport process. So it's kind of, it's a...
So you let the physics do the work, essentially.
Exactly, that's it. We let the physics do the work. And then we get to a spectrum. And from a kind of theorist's point of view, that's, or at least from my point of view, that's much nicer, because then you actually have some confidence that what you're doing is really founded upon something physical rather than an assumption. And if, and the goal of this is to test general relativity and to say, do black holes work anything like the way that Einstein's theory says that they do? And if you're testing it based on an assumption that you've made, well, your test is founded on the assumption. Whereas if you're testing it based on real first principles physics, you might have a lot more confidence that the result that you get out at the end is robust.
Well, Chris, I think it's fascinating that you're actually able to take these various concepts of physics and get something close to what we actually see in some of the most powerful and energetic astronomical phenomenon in the sky, which is fantastic. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Chris.
No problems.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks, Quincy and Chris. Now here's Alex with the sky at night.
Thank you for that, Anna. Up in the skies this month, Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt, is currently about 1.6 AU, that's 240 million kilometers, away from the Earth, and so is around magnitude 7, making it as close and as bright as it will be in our lifetimes. In fact, it won't be this close again until 4164. You can see it with binoculars in the constellation Leo, where it will be clearly visible for the rest of this month. Ceres, with a diameter of 590 miles, that's 950 kilometers, is the smallest dwarf planet under the IAU's 2006 definition of what is a planet, and will be visited by NASA's Dawn spacecraft in 2015. Comet Lulin, which I mentioned in detail last month, is still looking very nice and bright enough to be seen with binoculars as it crosses from Leo into Cancer. At the end of February, it made its closest approach to the Earth, where it became bright enough to be seen with the naked eye in a dark sky. It's currently best viewed in the early evening and is around magnitude 6, meaning best to use binoculars, although it will fade pretty rapidly as the month goes on and will need telescopes from mid-March onwards. Orion is still high in the sky, meaning that you're looking through less atmosphere, and so your telescope should be able to reveal its features in great detail, notably in the Orion Nebula, where you may just about be able to make out the elusive fifth and sixth stars of the Trapezium multiple star in the nebula's heart. And finally, Saturn is also nice and high and bright, near the hind foot of Leo, with its rings currently 2 degrees from being edge-on, so you would need a very powerful telescope to see them, whilst Venus is still at its peak brightness, and a dazzling sight in central Pisces, although through good binoculars or a telescope, it is clear that it is a rapidly waning crescent. And that's it for Sky at Night this month. Now back to Quinton and Anna.
And now it's the part of the show that I really dread. With jokes so bad they've been labelled a war crime by the Geneva Convention, it is the Astronomy Joke of the Month.
Welcome back, Jane.
Thank you, Michelle.
How would you like to hear a joke this month?
I'd love to hear one. I've missed them.
Excellent. Drum roll, please. What do you call a space magician?
I don't know. What do you call a space magician?
A flying sorcerer!
Thanks for that, Michelle. I'd just like to say the Astropod does not condone sorcery of any kind.
That's all we have for you this month. You can visit us at our website, www.ast.cam.ac.uk/astropod.
You can even subscribe to the Astropod from iTunes. Thanks for listening.
See you next month.